Thanks so much for being with us tonight, everyone. We're talking about oceans, the health of the oceans, fish species, and what's happening around the planet. And we just heard from Rupert Murray over the last hour about his film, The End of the Line, and sort of painting the broad strokes of this picture, and it's pretty grim. Now we turn to Chef Rick Moonen, who I don't know if you've seen Rick. He's been on the Today Show a lot. He's been on Oprah. He was a star at the Culinary Institute of America, worked at some of the finest restaurants in New York, moved out to Las Vegas in February of 2005 to open his RM Seafood at Mandalay Bay. And it's the most popular seafood place in Las Vegas. But at the same time, as I told you in the introduction to the program, it seems kind of incongruous, but he's also campaigning for people not to eat fish in some regards. He's considered an authority on environmental and sustainable seafood issues, has testified all over the country, has joined a couple of Seafood Choices Alliances and other organizations, and he's written a cookbook called Fish Without a Doubt, published in 2008, that sort of gives all of us some suggestions on how we can contribute. Rick, you there?
Yes, I am, George. Good to hear from you.
Thanks for being here. I'd like to start with the story of how your involvement in sustainable seafood started. You were working in New York, and you'd go down to the fish markets to buy fish.
That's right. Yeah, I was at the Fulton Fish Market, which is, you know, for me, it was one of the most exciting parts of my job because there's a lot of activity that would go on there. But, you know, and that's really where I educated myself on seafood, you know, and a lot of changes. Over the years, I've unfortunately have been noticing, you know, and how I got involved. Here I am, I'm a chef. I graduated from culinary school, you know, and you're trying to take care of your guests. You know, and your guests are, there's a certain bond that a chef and their guests have. It's a trust. They trust that you're going to source out their food, that it's going to be healthy for them, and that you're going to know where it came from. Well, in the world of seafood, sometimes that's not so easy. And as I'm going through my culinary career, I'm noticing that people start to have concerns about where their food comes from, how it's caught. They want to know if the tuna that they're ordering from the menu has been netted or if it was line caught, because the netting is, they've been reading that it was killing dolphins. And, you know, and they were concerned about the dolphins being killed as bycatch to the tuna target. And, you know, then I started to realize early on that people, they want to know more about their food. You know, it wasn't just about cooking and recipes anymore, you know. And here I am going down to the Fulton Fish Market, and I'm buying a lot of swordfish because I'm at a restaurant called the Water Club. And we're doing $12 million a year in business, and we did a lot of it in banquets. So I'd buy entire 200-pound, what they call double marker swordfish. And little by little, you know, they started to become less and less frequently available at the Fulton Fish Market. The size started to diminish. They started to get down towards 100-pounders, you know, and those are called single markers or anything and below 100 pounds is called the pup. And pups started to become more the norm. And everyone just seemed to just roll along with it without any kind of notice that the size of the fish and the frequency of it has just started to diminish.
But you realize something's wrong.
Well, I noticed that something was wrong, but no one was raising an alarm towards it. It just seemed to be okay. You know, you'd go to the Fulton Fish Market and no one's discussing that the fish are small. It's like, oh, yeah, that's what we got today. You know, it was sort of flippantly dealt with.
Well, what does it mean that it's a swordfish is only 100 pounds? What are you getting?
Well, unfortunately, the 100-pound swordfish hasn't even reached sexual maturity yet, and that becoming the norm on the market, if you gave it a lot of thought, I've been just trying to, you know, shop for protein for your restaurant, you're fishing the babies. And that's really what started to happen. It was, and I got a phone call from Nora Pouillon, who had who's got an all-organic restaurant down in Washington, D.C. She was approached by a collaboration of the NRDC, the National Resources Defense Council, and CWEB. The two of them got together, and they started this awareness program called Give Swordfish a Break. Now, this is 15 years ago. And Nora said to me that, you know, they have calculated that within the next 5 years, if nothing was going to be done about the North Atlantic swordfish, that it was going to become commercially extinct. Now, I'd never heard that word before, commercially extinct. So I had to ask, what do you mean? She's like, well, basically, it's so overfished that it's not even going to pay to put gas in your boat to go out to get it. And I'm thinking, I'm seeing the fish get smaller. I'm seeing the fish look older as they're coming into the market. Some of them, it's taking them longer to go out and fill up their boats to make it worth their while to come back. This was going on 15 years ago. You know, and then you see the perfect storm. People start to get, brings us to today where there's more of an aha. But back then, there was a critical moment where if the North Atlantic swordfish wasn't eased off on, or something didn't change internationally, that it could have possibly gone into commercial extinction. It did not, but that was a result of ICAT, which is an international organization. And there was enough of a campaign, enough of a voice that was spread, thankfully, through this effort, Give Swordfish a Break, where it became commonplace. I mean, it was, you know, the talk shows at night would come up. I would go out. It was funny because here I am, a seafood chef in New York City. I'm getting like my hair cut or something, and people, you know, need to have a discussion with someone that you haven't met before. And they're like, what do you do for a living? Well, I have a seafood restaurant. And they started telling me not to serve swordfish. I knew then that it was successful. And that's what happened. People getting together in a unified manner and creating a voice helps nature to rebound. You know, there was large areas that were cited as, nurseries for swordfish became no fish zones. The way that they counted the fish, you know, these long lines that went out, some of them, if it wasn't the right size, they could throw it back and say, well, that doesn't count. No, it does count now. Every fish that you hook counts, and it's going to be. And then they started to put counters on boats. And now the North Atlantic swordfish, 15 years later, is considered sustainable, which is, you know, and that's how it started for me. And then along the way, you know, I started out as a kind of a voice for Give Swordfish a Break. I sort of became their poster child for one reason or another. It was something that I truly believed in. I had a personal testimony because I'd seen the changes in the swordfish at the Fulton Fish Market. This wasn't some fabricated story. But I wasn't jumping on board with something that I didn't actually have a hand in on. I was buying a lot of swordfish at the time, you know. I stopped buying swordfish because of it.
Do you have people say, hey, it's kind of weird for you, you're a chef, you make your living cooking fish, to tell people not to eat fish?
Well, no, yeah, it would seem that way. But the reality of it is, and why would you write a fish book? If people don't like to cook fish at home, why would you write a book that helps them to cook fish at home? Don't you want them to come in your restaurant and spend money? Yeah, that makes complete sense. But what I'm asking people to do is kind of step outside that narrow box of acceptability of what they want to eat out of the ocean and expand it, because there's a lot of species of fish that are available to us. Now, if you just kind of like eat salmon on Monday, maybe. So it's salmon, tuna, and shrimp. Those are the trio that I call the big three. Now, if we could start stepping and eat some mackerel, eat some sardines, eat some sustainably farm-raised, you know, tilapia or farm-raised catfish in the United States, you know, and shake it up a little bit to where you get your omega-3 fatty acids into your diet, because now we understand that's good for our health, and you'll be easing up on the targeted species, the ones that are really, really being drilled down upon. And those are, I mean, if speaking earlier, I believe you were talking about The End of the Line, which is a tremendous, tremendous film. The documentary, I couldn't sit still in my seat watching it. It was just about time that it was put into a documentary form. It was really well done. You know, I've been seeing what was being shown in that documentary. I've been seeing it happen for many, many years, and it just hasn't been put together in such a succinct manner as The End of the Line, and I applaud it.
Chef Rick Moonen is our guest. He's also the author of a book called Fish Without a Doubt. When we come back, we'll get into that and some other issues about, basically people who don't believe we need to be concerned about what's happening to our oceans. Stay with us here on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast. I'm George Knapp. We're talking about sustainable seafood, the push to sort of save our oceans and some of the species that are now endangered in our oceans with our guest, Chef Rick Moonen. And Rick, do you get customers who tell you, it's a bunch of baloney? I don't believe that. The oceans are vast. There's no threat. There's plenty of fish in the sea.
No, my customers, not normally, but I do have these discussions. I've had these discussions over the years at the Fulton Fish Market, talking to purveyors. I mean, I've been pretty emphatic about how I order, and I'm not secretive about how I feel when I talk to my purveyors. I beat them up a little bit. I scream at them, why do you have Chilean sea bass on it? You want me to order from you? I'll squeeze them to take it out or take it off. And they'll take it off the list of things that they offer to me, you know, but... You know, so there's a cat and mouse game that I've played with these guys, but you know, to me, I take it very, very seriously.
One of our listeners sent me an email earlier today. His name is Steve Green. He lives up in Alaska, and he says all the streams in Alaska are showing poor numbers of returning king salmon, but the pink and the silver are running fairly strong. You had an experience, in addition to that Fulton Fish Market thing with swordfish, you had an experience in Alaska regarding salmon of your own. Tell me that story.
Well, I went up to Emonic, and that's where the Yukon River empties out into the Bering Sea. You know, and the Bering Sea has become very popular because of a television show called the Deadliest Catch. The Yukon River is very unique in the fish that swim in it, and especially the king salmon. It's a 2,000-mile river. In order for a salmon, after a salmon is born, it hatches, it grows. It's at the beginning of a river in the mountains. It's basically like a trout. It's living in fresh, spring, beautiful water. It gets to a certain size. Nature tells it it's time to go down the river. As it's going down the river towards the ocean, it's taking a snapshot. It's basically learning the taste of the water, the waterfalls, and all the twists and turns that it takes. And genetically, when it goes, by the time it gets to the salt water, the ocean, it has gone through a transformation to ready itself to go into the ocean. Its diet changes and everything does. It goes out and lives for a few years and grows to be a majestic size. It needs to build up within its body enough fat to make it back up that river. Because once it hits the river to go back to reproduce, it no longer eats, so it needs to store that fat. Now, if you have to make it up a 2,000-mile river going against the current, going up, you know, the waterfalls and the currents and everything else that you know, get in its way, you have to have a tremendous amount of fat. What does that mean in my world, the culinary world? Delicious. I mean, it's the best of the best. Now, you know, you get Columbia River, or, you know, you get Copper River King salmon. Copper River King, big popular fish. This is a 500-mile river. This is four times the size. So I had to go up there. I had an opportunity. I met with a group of people and went up and saw the Eskimos that have been living up there for 10,000 years. And when I say up there, I mean in the middle of nowhere. It's the tundra. You're flying in on small airplanes. You're landing in mud. There are no sidewalks. But there's the best fish I ever ate in my entire life. And I went up just at the beginning, when the beginning of the king salmon season would normally start. And this is last year. And during that time, I'm working with the Alaska. I was allowed to stand side by side with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game, and they take like a census. They put nets out and they find out how strong the run is, so they can determine how many fish can be caught. You know, you have to let a certain number go up so it's sustainable. You know, there's more fish next year. Otherwise, we capture everything, we're done. Well, the numbers weren't strong enough to allow for a commercial fishing situation that happened last year or this year. Now, I have my own theory on why that's happening.
Well, let's hear it.
Okay. Well, in the middle of the Bering Sea, where no one is watching, there's these gigantic super trawlers the size of city blocks. Russian and Japan and a lot of countries are represented there. And they're going after a fish called pollock. Now, pollock, you know, is a multi-billion dollar business industry. And there really isn't much talked about pollock, you know, in the normal everyday life of most people, because it's processed. It's a fish that goes into a processing plant. It turns into surimi, that artificial crab meat, because it's got a really good protein. It's kind of mushy as a fish, so you don't normally see it like in a restaurant situation, but you do see it in supermarkets constantly. But it's in frozen form. It's processed into the fish sticks, the frozen pucks, and whatever fingers, anything that you get frozen in a restaurant, or, I mean, in a fast food restaurant or a supermarket, is pollock. Now, it's because it's a multi-billion dollar industry, they pick up other fish as they're going after pollock, and it's called bycatch. And because it's such a large industry, the bycatch percentage may sound small, but it's a large number of fish, enough fish, and then that's where the salmon are going. The salmon get caught incidentally in a pollock industry, and then they don't return, and then there's not enough salmon to create a strong enough return to those individual rivers. This is going on, and no one seems to be talking about it.
And it's like this bycatch, it's like billions of pounds of seafood, turtles and dolphins and all kinds of things, and I guess salmon, and they just throw it away?
They have to, because they don't have a license for it. You know, and there's people like I said earlier, there's counters. There's people on these boats. There's one counter on a city-sized boat that's and I say they're floating factories. What they pull in that day, by the end of that day, is in package form. What they download, what they unload off of these things are ready to go onto a supermarket shelf. I mean, they're just amazingly efficient machines, and the fish just can't keep up with it. But they still aren't so efficient that they can just target exactly what they're going after.
And so it's not just their power to scoop up fish at an amazing rate, but it's also what they do to the bottom of the ocean, right? Some of them, the trawlers.
Well, the trawlers are ridiculous. It would be like clear cutting a forest to get the deer for your game dinner, you know. And then you leave them no place to live. The habitat destruction is a major concern. And the funny thing is, you know, 15 years ago when I got involved, I was mostly concerned about overfishing. I'm like, it's silly for me as a chef, considered a gatekeeper and an influential, you know, directive in the world of cuisine, to be taking active part in the destruction or the eradication, the extinction of a species. It made absolutely no responsible sense to me. So, I mean, I didn't really take into consideration the bycatch scenarios or the habitat destruction or the negative effects of aquaculture. I thought farm-raised salmon was the best thing since sliced white bread until I learned the detrimental effects that it has on the ecosystem. And then health risks have always been there. I mean, we've been spewing, methylmercury into the air by burning coal for many, 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 many years, and then all of a sudden we're surprised that it's in our food. Well, you know, guess what?
Yeah, and yet we as consumers are told for years, fish is good for you. Eat more fish. Eat less beef.
We in our lifetime, George, let's face facts. We've been batted across. Just talk about eggs. Are they good for us this week?
Yeah.
Are eggs bad this week? I don't know. You know, I mean, is beef good for you this week or next week? You know, there's just so much confusion that goes. Now, fish, seafood, it's so misunderstood. But the realities of it is, if we don't change our diets, we don't change the way we're catching them. And catching is we're hunting them because they're still wild. If we don't stop what we've been doing for the last 50 years, they're going to be gone by the middle of the century. That's ridiculous. And if the ocean collapses, so does everything else. It's 2/3 of our globe.
And you've been seeing this. I mean, you talked about the example of the North Atlantic swordfish, but you've been seeing this in other species in terms of their availability for your restaurant.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, and there's some that don't seem to be significant in too many people's worlds. You know, and it's regional. I mean, I saw tilefish, for instance. It's not a fish that many people speak of, but they used to be available for 99 cents a pound. These gigantic fish with big heads, flaky white flesh. And it was delicious. Now, you go to the Fulton Fish Market, they look like tropical fish. I mean, they really do. They look like tiny little, you know, trout when they were like these gigantic, lumbering, beautiful fish.
Chilean shark?
Oh, shark? Yeah, I used to serve shark. I had shark on my menu at one point. You know, at least we ate the shark, not just the fins, and threw the rest of the animal overboard. I mean, that is just like a ridiculously inefficient ceremonial pastime that certain cultures adhere to. You know, that shark fin soup is important in their diet for some reason. I can't wrap my fingers around that, because we're destroying the ecosystem.
Chef Rick Moonen has written a book giving you some advice on how you can make a difference in what you choose to eat and how you prepare it. When we come back, we'll get into talking about that. Stay with us on Coast to Coast AM. Glad you're with us, everyone, tonight. Let's say you go into a restaurant. When was the last time you told the waiter or waitress, hey, bring me some of that slime fish you've got on the menu? We're talking about problems with overfishing and what it's done to certain species. Part of it is a marketing decision. As we're learning tonight, slimefish has been renamed into something that sounds a lot tastier, Chilean sea bass. It's a marketing thing that's been devastating for the fish species itself. When we come back, our conversation with Chef Rick Moonen continues. We're going to get into some specifics on what kind of fish you can eat that would make the planet and the oceans a better place. Stay with us on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. My guest is Chef Rick Moonen, who wrote a book called Fish Without a Doubt. Rick, in the tease there, I know I made a mistake. I was talking about slime fish and Chilean sea bass. Chilean sea bass, the actual name is what? Patagonian toothfish, right?
Correct, yep. And what? Slime head. It's known as Orange Ruffy. Nice, sweet, wonderful name, isn't it?
That sounds a lot better.
Well, that's just, George, that's perfect, because that shows you the confusion is deep. and anything can go. I mean, you can just rename a fish. If Patagonian toothfish renamed Chilean sea bass, popularized the fish to almost, now it's an endangered species because more than 50% of what comes in the United States is pirated. It's illegally caught.
All right. You have a seafood restaurant. You serve fish. You have to respond to what the public wants. How do you deal with the request for Chilean sea bass?
I tell them that I don't serve it because it's for the very reasons I just explained. But if in order to satisfy that jonesing, say they want that fish, that flesh, and it's delicious. Don't get me wrong. I love Chilean sea bass. I think it's delicious, and it's very easy to serve. You can cook it almost any way you want, and the success rate is 90% at least. Well, there's other fish that are more sustainable. Like the Alaskan fishery, for instance, is very, very good. They do a great job of regulating and maintaining their species into healthy populations. Sablefish or black cod, those are the two names that they go into the market most commonly, is a cold water fish, and it's got a tremendously fatty texture and quality to it that mirrors the Chilean sea bass. I mean, if you can, it becomes a good substitute in a recipe form.
So basically, in your restaurant, you look for stuff. If somebody orders X, you look for Y, that it's
correct,
just as good or tastes similar, and you try to steer them towards something that is sustainable.
Well, I want people to understand that it's not that difficult, and that sustainability tastes great. That was my goal when I set out to do Fish Without a Doubt. It took 4 years because in the middle of it, I opened up a restaurant in Las Vegas, Nevada. So I took a little hiatus on the completion of the book. But there was a lot of concerns about cooking seafood at home, and I did a little census before I set out to write the book. And a lot of it is, well, I don't know how to pick it up. I don't feel skilled to select my seafood. It's expensive. I'm afraid I'm going to overcook it because I hear that's the number one fault that people at home, they overcook their seafood. I don't know how to hold it. There was just so many fears around. I'm like, okay, it's not that difficult. First of all, you have this, and it smells up my kitchen. That was a beauty. It smells fishy in my house. I love
the fishy, word fishy. Yeah, the fishy smell, right?
Well, the thing of it is, and I say, look, if you're roasting prime rib, and the family arrives at home 2 hours after it's been slowly roasting in the oven, they don't walk in the door and go, "Ooh, it smells beefy in here." it's food, and if you select it and it's fresh, and it smells like dinner to me, and that's what I wanted to prove. It there's a little too much anxiety, and there's good reason for it. If you could take a fish, Patagonian toothfish, and call it Chilean sea bass, and it's not even a bass, and how that's okay. Well, there's a lot of funny things that can go on, but it isn't as hard as you think, and that's why I wrote Fish Without a Doubt.
All right, salmon. If I don't want to eat salmon, what could I eat instead to give salmon a break?
Well, Arctic char is a good selection. I call it salmon light. In this world of everything being made into a lighter style, well, then salmon light is Arctic char, and it's farm raised in a sustainable manner because it's a closed containment system, so it doesn't have a negative impact on the natural environment. There's no escapes, and it's a delicious fish.
All right, this issue of farm raised, Rupert Murray talked about some concerns with certain kinds of farm raised fish, whether it creates more problems than it solves, and you're using lots of tiny fish that are gathered out of the ocean to create a larger fish. You got to be worried about that.
I'm totally worried about that. I'm concerned about the entire ecosystem collapsing. You wouldn't think that. I'd pull your car off to the side of the road for no good reason, open up the hood, pull a piece of the engine out, throw it to the side of the road, and expect it to drive the same. Well, we're allowing the collapse of certain species in our own lifetime. I mean, the North Atlantic cod, sardines. I mean, the sardine factory. I mean, come on. There was Monterey, California. Hemingway wrote a book. It was Cannery Row. Used to be
Steinbeck.
teeming with Steinbeck. Thank you. See, we're both. I didn't correct you on air.
Sorry.
John Steinbeck wrote the book Cannery Row. Correct. And there's no more sardines that are being harvested anymore. And in a part of the world that used to be, they would be flipping out of the water. It's Chesapeake Bay, to go back to the East Coast, used to be the most prolific estuary in the world, and now it's hardly producing anything worth talking about.
I had read something about farmed catfish being a concern because of hormones or steroids or something they pump into these fish.
Well, yeah. Here's a problem because it depends on what part of the world, and it even depends on what part of that market. To make matters even a little bit more complicated, I am trying to simplify it. But yeah, catfish. You could go out in your backyard with a garden hose, fill up a hole, and raise catfish. It's a brackish water fish. But it depends on now. The product that's going to come out of it is going to depend on how you handle that pond that you create and the feed that you give. The good thing about catfish is it's a vegetarian. So you don't have to go out and find more fish protein to create the pellets to feed it. But the downside is, you make an investment, and you have a super high, if you're not doing it exactly the way it should be, you overpopulate an area, you create a stress on them. When in a stressed, overpopulated scenario, if one of them gets sick, they all get sick. So you have to use certain antibiotics. Or if you want to move it along and some big company tells you, hey, you just got to give them this, it's a hormone, they grow faster, you buy into that. And then we're diluting the food that we eat. So you need to know your source when it comes to certain catfish. But generally speaking, as a rule of thumb, U.S. farm-raised catfish is sustainable and wholesome and healthy.
I want to talk about the shark fin soup. We've touched on it earlier in the program. So I'm a big shot Asian high roller. I come to Las Vegas. I'm spending a lot of money. I go into your restaurant and I want shark fin soup. What happens?
I can't help you out.
Yeah.
And that's where I draw the line. I mean, I don't. Shark is a part of the ecosystem, and even Peter Benchley, when he became an environmentalist after Jaws, because of the negative impact that people had on and the disregard for a part of the food chain. And even though they're major predators, they perform a major function, and they help clean up and keep some balance in an ecosystem that needs a lot of help right now, and sharks are a major player in it. So I can't, with any due conscience, satisfy that person's request.
You can't, but you know, I mean, you're the celebrity chef. You know all these guys, the big shot restaurateurs in the country. You know that some of them do it, and some of them continue to do it. Some of the most famous ones. I don't know if you want to call them out, but I will.
Then I'll let you do it.
All right, Nobu. I mean, this. I think Robert De Niro is a part owner in this chain, and they keep serving it, right?
I believe that they may. I know there's a bluefin tuna discussion around
Oh,
that.
bluefin tuna, right.
Yeah. And I know that Nobu has a lot of respect for, at least I have a lot of respect for Nobu. I know in my own world, I mean, I changed some of my own approaches to seafood when I tasted the food from Nobu's restaurants. I have such a deep respect for him. In this manner, I mean, in this discussion, though, bluefin tuna's gonna go is on the such so close to being extinct that it's a matter of just it's within everyone's lifetime right now that's listening. It's that close.
Rick, as you know, in Las Vegas, I mean, it's a gambling town, and it relies to a great deal on Asian high rollers who come in and spend a bunch of money. A lot of the hotels and restaurants in the hotels have taken shark fin soup off the menu, but they will still serve it sort of almost under the table. Do you agree with that it happens?
I think it's better if you want to know the truth. I mean, as a chef, okay, I have two hats here. You catch me on a fence. I mean, at me, my restaurant, no, I'm not going to serve shark fin soup ever. I will not. I refuse it. It's just ridiculous. It's so against everything that I believe in as a person. Forget as a chef, as a human being, I don't believe in it, George. And as far as a chef, But I have to dial back 20 years ago, and it was genetically engineered foods. That's really where I first became outspoken about government policies, et cetera. There was the genetically engineered foods were being distributed without any kind of free market safety testing, and there was no mandatory labeling. And I was appalled by that when I found out that was going on. And, you know, because we trust that our government is taking care of certain things, you know, and I became a activist chef, you know, long before I thought that I was going to be doing it. I mean, I was most interested in cooking and taking care of customers. And I just got deeply involved in the seafood when it was presented to me. It was a good swordfish or break.
I want to make sure you're right about Nobu. It's the bluefin tuna issue, mm-hmm. not the shark fin soup. But that's just as bad in your book, I guess. But I understand he's a colleague of yours. You don't want to get into it.
Well, it would be difficult for me to say anything because, I mean, genetically engineered foods. What I was preaching back 20 years ago was my customer's not specifically asking for it. Therefore, I don't want to carry it, and I want to know. By labeling that I can make a choice, and I wasn't being given that choice. So I felt as though if guests are asking for it, if people understand everything there is to understand about it, and they still want it, that's Nobu's stand, and I have to respect that, although I don't personally believe in it.
Okay. All right. You've made some alliances with some environmental organizations, Wildlife Conservation Society, and something called SeaWeb. And I remember when we first met, we talked about this, how diners, how people who go out to restaurants can carry this thing along with them to give them immediate information about their choices concerning seafood. Tell me that story.
Oh, this is very simple. I mean, these are little cards that fold up and sit into your wallet. And we live in a land of, in a world of immediate information, too. Applications on your iPhone, anything, you know, it's at your fingertips. There's no longer an excuse to not be able to select wisely and more sustainably, and the one organization that I support wholeheartedly, it comes from Monterey Bay Aquariums. It's called Seafood Watch, and you can get a Seafood Watch application for free on your iPhone, and you can dial certain numbers on I forget the exact, and I don't have it off the top of my head, but I know there's you can text certain numbers and get answers back. If you're in a restaurant and you're looking at a menu. And it has on the menu, let's just say, Orange Ruffy. And you're not sure. Oh, I remember hearing about Orange Ruffy the other day. I was listening to it. And you're not 100% sure. You can take out your card, look it up, and notice that it's under the red zone or it's where you're supposed to be avoiding the fish. Or you can punch it into your phone, and it'll come up and tell you better alternatives. And it's pretty cool. And it makes it so simple. It's basically like looking at a traffic light. If it's green, it's good. Everything about it is good. It's healthy, it's sustainable, and you have very few concerns. If it's yellow, well, there might be a few concerns, but they're still all right. You know, so if you can't find anything in the green, yellow's okay. Red, stay away from. It's pretty simple.
And in your restaurant, I mean, people can go in there, they can ask the kind of questions that Rupert Murray was suggesting that they should ask. Hey, where did this fish come from? They can do that in your place. Is that catching on? I mean, can I go to a typical seafood restaurant and say, hey, where'd you get that halibut?
I think it's becoming more commonplace, but as I speak to more and more chefs. And there's been a really good movement in Las Vegas, Nevada. I mean, believe it or not, Sin City is making more movements towards a sustainable future than I saw in New York City over a 25-year period that I was there. Now, it could have been a sign of the times. New York City may very well be catching up and doing it. But I was stirring a lot of pots for many, many years, trying to get people's attention, saying, hey, this is happening. And it wasn't the sky is falling scenario. I mean, I'm a chef. And I'm saying, we should really be cooling it out on this. You know, monkfish got into a point where we were overfishing it. You know, red snapper out of the Gulf. There's a lot of fish that have got big concerns that aren't day-to-day discussions. I mean, Chilean sea bass is more of an understanding because there's emotion behind it. Take a pass on Chilean sea bass. There's a campaign around it, an awareness campaign, just like the swordfish had. Give a break. I mean, there's a take a pass on sea bass, you know, because it's cool, it's catchy. They're trying to one species at a time raise awareness. Well, unfortunately, there's more than just a couple at a time that can be handled. There's handfuls. So that's why these cards become very useful tools.
Well, give me a list. What else should consumers, customers, diners be avoiding, at least for a while, give them a break?
Okay, well, in Florida, I lived in Key West, Florida, and I lived in the land of groupers. Most groupers are overfished. Red snapper, overfished. Monkfish, like I just mentioned, overfished. Skate was overfished. Now skate is a problem. See, now you got to keep track, boys and girls, because it changes. You got to have your current program. It almost feels, and there's some reality to that. Well, have some fun with it, because I mean, if you're going to eat seafood, then keep up on it. And these seafood watch cards are constantly being updated, and they're regional. You can get Northeast buying guide, or national, and you can get a national guide, and they're all dated. All right, to get back to the question at hand, there's red snapper. Some imported swordfish, the biggest of the tuna species, the big eye, the yellowfin, some yellowfin's okay, some yellowfin's not. So just to make it confusing, and definitely the bluefin tuna is, it's as bad as it's going to get. You're right, it's like you're flying your airplane on fumes.
Is that being sold and served in Las Vegas in restaurants?
Bluefin tuna?
Yeah.
I'm sure it is. I would be lying to you if I said no. It certainly never makes it into my restaurant. There's, you know, I'll use some ahi tuna, which is line caught from Hawaii, which is sustainable. I do have tuna in my restaurant, but it's a sustainable tuna, and I hope that tuna as an entire species doesn't become endangered, you know, in the future. And if we're careful about it, there is going to be a future, because fish have an amazing ability to rebound, George. And if we all got on a rocket ship and just took off for a couple of years and then came back to the planet, things would be so much better. We get in the way. It's technology. It's the inability of these wild species to keep up with our technology.
Well, give me a thumbnail sketch of the other side of the coin. If we don't jump on a rocket ship and all leave, and we don't give some of these species a break, what the immediate future or near future holds?
Well, if we start, okay, there are healthy things that we can do. I mean, I'm not saying everybody has to do this, but I mean, oysters, mussels, clams, oysters, all of the, they're filter feeders. They help clean up the ocean. There's some of the reasons, the main reason that certain, you know, estuaries collapsed, because we just ate up all the wild oysters, and they were keeping everything clean. It's like you fired the cleaning woman and wondered why your carpet was dirty, you know. And then the next thing, and so the eelgrass that used to be growing beautifully in that clean water goes away, and that's where the fish used to hide. It's just one thing. It's a chain reaction. Ecosystem is a chain reaction. One thing has to come about in order for the next thing to happen. So clams, oysters, all the shellfish are really, really good. And the more that we consume, the more farming will take place, the cleaner the oceans.
All right, Chef Rick Moonen, take a break. We'll come back with more of your suggestions, and we'll open up the phone lines if our listeners have questions for you here on Coast to Coast AM. I'm George Knapp. Don't go away.